My friend Morgan Lambert died last month. He was the program director for KTAH, one of the stations this show airs on. I do not have a lot of details yet, but I am told he died of natural causes. Morgan was the first person I met in my community radio journey who had the same love for it I did. Most everyone else would ask me why real radio was so important to me, but Morgan brought his own reasons that amplified my own. When I felt like what I was doing was meritless, like I did for the 2018 election coverage, it was Morgan who made the importance clear to me, and then he worked hard to make his vision a reality, and I was lucky enough to help engineer it. His kindness and his appreciation for his fellow person was exactly the thing that I simultaneously advocated for and found difficult to approach on my own. That kindness helped me accomplish things that I would not have been able to do on my own, and I had hoped to return the favor someday. I've been waiting to hear from Morgan to tell him about some positive developments in some radio-related projects that we'd long been skeptical about, yet hopeful for. There will always be a part of me that is waiting to have that conversation now. Thank you, Morgan.
Hello, and welcome to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. This week you got me, Becky Friedman, sitting in the host chair, and I am very pleased on this solstice day plus one to have with me in the studio, Nick and Luke. How are you guys?
Doing great.
I'm feeling fantastic. The days are not going to be as short as they were.
At least for us here in the Northern Hemisphere.
Something to look forward to. Spring is on its way.
In the meantime, we do have an email from DJ from Sydney where, oh, I'm sorry, DJ, but your daylight minutes are going to be decreasing. But I do hope that you have a good, awesome summer solstice. DJ asks us, will the guys be singing Dominic the Donkey again on the show, being Christmas and all? Big resounding chickity chick no!
That song isn't nearly as cringy as Pablo the Reindeer from Mexico.
Is that a thing?
Yes, it is. Okay. I sang it with my elementary school music class.
That rings a bell, but I'm not super familiar with it.
Well, we do have some other music inquiries. Aaron's B from the internet writes, I absolutely get the host's hatred for Christmas music. 97% of it gives all of it a bad name. But then there's the remaining 3%. Let me just throw out there Halfords of Judas Priest fame. Get into the spirit. Now, it took a little bit of getting into the spirit to bring me to listen to the Songs of Winter from Halford. It was new to me. And as purveyors and consumers of a perhaps wider variety of music than myself, Luke, you being a punk fan, and Nick, you being a musician that has been a perennial performer in the greater Tacoma area, what have you to say about Halford's Songs of Winter?
I liked it better than Jingle Bells.
That is kind of a low bar, I imagine.
It reminded me of newer Ozzy in the fact that I don't really enjoy it that much. But on top of that, it's older style metal, and that's not really my genre of interest. But it wasn't terrible.
Nick?
I respect Rob Halford and his many decades of work, and I am not a metal fan. I don't really care for this. It's not for me. However, it is a lot better than Pablo the Reindeer from Mexico.
You're really stuck on this Pablo the Reindeer from Mexico. Even last I checked, there were no reindeer that were endemic to any region of Mesoamerica. How about this one, though? Libby from the internet says, overly aggressive Tool fans are really gnawing at me lately. I don't know, Libby, is there like a religion or an atheism angle in there? Is overly aggressive Tool fan bordering on religiosity?
Yes.
Is that because you personally know, or you personally participate as an overly aggressive Tool fan?
I appreciate Tool as a band. I really enjoy them. They're awesome. I haven't seen them since 2001 because getting tickets is an impossibility.
A lot of progressive rock bands like Tool, or going back even further with Rush and Yes, they have a cult following. For the record, I play in a prog rock band. I understand the fandom. However, Tool fans, please be nice.
The thing is, Tool put out their album, earlier this year? And it hit number one in the charts, and people were like, who's this? They're like ancient. Why are they number one?
because their fans were waiting for this album to come out for, what, over a decade?
It was like 12 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're fervent, rabid fans.
Okay. Well, there's something about me that, says, okay, that's one level of annoyance. But in terms of overly aggressive, let's leap out of the realm of music for a moment and go to politics, where an independent Washington State congressional investigation into Spokane area Republican Representative Matt Shea has concluded that Shea planned and promoted domestic terrorism related to the 2016 Malheur National Wildlife Refuge occupation and represents a present and growing threat of risk to others through political violence. The findings also state that Shea suggested surveillance of opponents and encouraged his loyalists to intimidate activists, government officials, Muslims, and others who speak in opposition to his personal beliefs and personal agenda. Upon presentation of the findings, House Minority Leader J.T. Wilcox barred Shea from caucusing with the Republicans, stripped him of all committee assignments, and told him to find a new office. Shea vowed not to resign, echoing Donald Trump in saying he was the victim of a so-called sham investigation, in his case, aimed at disarming and destroying the nation. The Washington State House of Representatives can expel a legislator with a two-thirds vote, which has only occurred once in the state's history when a lawmaker was booted in 1933 for child sex abuse.
It looks like this guy actually may have used his position as a representative to spy on the happenings in the police camp and then brought that information to the people that took over the reserve and shared it with them.
This is really, really unbecoming of a lawmaker or a legislator or political leader by any measure at this point, especially given that the affiliations of all of the individuals who are looking at doing occupation of national lands and refuges and things like that are inextricably linked. They're infected with not just this extreme libertarianism and extreme, you know, anti-government view, but inextricably linked that with Christianity and with the superiority of a Christian existence and Christian state.
Yeah, this is extreme super libertarianism with racism and Christian supremacy thrown on top of that.
I think that there's going to be a lot of unpacking of this. It is a 108-page report, and you can actually, we'll post the links at atheist.radio in our show notes for this episode. But, you know, this is sort of getting a lot of press now, where we say, oh, look, there is a congressional report that has deemed this person to be engaging in domestic terrorism and promoting domestic terrorism. I got to give shout outs to the Spokesman Review, which is the newspaper in Spokane County. And then, of all places, The Guardian, published in the UK, and then also Rolling Stone, that really for the past 2 years have been doing digs into Matt Shea, his participations and links in different groups, the way that he has been participating in all of the surveillance. And when I look at the House Minority Leader, J.T. Wilcox, saying, hey, you're voted off the island, we don't want anything to do with you, why are you waiting until this juncture? To me, that speaks to a disbelief in investigative journalism and a distrust of the really, really in-depth work that investigative journalists have been doing into Matt Shea, have been looking through public records requests to find these kinds of things on him. It was only called into question once the congressional independent investigation report was presented to the House. I don't want to give J.T. Wilcox too many props here for waiting until this juncture to say, oh, this is terrible. Oh, my goodness. I mean, he's doing a lot of pearl clutching here from my perspective. What do you think, Nick?
I was actually just about to bring up pearl clutching, but something like this is so easily dismissed these days because of the nature that they have that, well, one side of U.S. politics these days has pushed forth a narrative of fake news. And anything that they don't like that doesn't immediately line up with their narrative, they just cast off as like, oh, that didn't happen.
Matt Shea can call this a scam investigation all he wants, but he is not getting out of this one. People are not going to dismiss this thing as fake news. You're listening to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. We'll be back after the break with an awesome discussion with one of our favorite guests, David Fitzgerald. Stay tuned. And welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. As we go into the Christmas season, David Fitzgerald is a writer and historical researcher whose works range from sci-fi to nonfiction. He's been a guest on Ask an Atheist before to talk about his sci-fi adventure series Time Shards that he co-authored with his partner Dana Fredstee. But today, David's here to talk with us about Jesus. How are you, David?
I'm good. So glad to be here again.
You know, you first published Nailed, your book Nailed, that's 10 Christian myths that show that Jesus never existed at all. You're coming up on a decade, right?
It is. It's about time to come out with a 10-year anniversary of that book.
You know, we first crossed paths with you in person when you'd written that and we're promoting that. And now you've actually expanded your research to a 3-book follow-up series called Jesus Mything in Action. Is that correct?
Mything in Action. That is absolutely right. And the funny thing is, I didn't really expect to be doing any more talk about Jesus after I came out with Nailed. But it occurred to me almost immediately from the reaction that while it pointed out all the top 10 ways that the official Christian story just does not hold up at all, it didn't say anything about where I really thought Christianity came from and the mythicists that I follow, you know, what the theories on that were. And so Mything in Action tackles all the other parts that Nailed doesn't cover. It talks about what our sources for Jesus say and what it tells us about him and what it inside and outside the New Testament. And it's about as much as you'll ever want to know about Jesus without being a complete phone book of a novel to read.
You say phone book and novel. I mean, at some point, you were kind of amassing so much research. You're like, I got to break this into two
right.
feature movies, right?
Yeah, it happened when I was talking to our audiobook editor. And I said, okay, I'm a little nervous about this book because it's over a quarter of a million words. And, you know, it's going to be about 500, 600 pages. And he says, whoa, wait, what was the word count again? And I told him, and he says, okay, is that for 6.5 by 9 or is that 8.5 by 11? I went, oh no, when it's page size on your computer, it's a completely different format than when it's page size for the book. So it would have almost been a 1,000-page book if we left it alone. So that's why we broke it up into 3 books. But basically, it's one big book talking about these different aspects of the Jesus question, the historicity question.
So that really is the crux here, this historicity question. And, you know, our listeners will know that I did not grow up believing in Jesus. I came from a Jewish background. And even for me, it wasn't until I was kind of immersed in the atheist community that it dawned to me to even hypothesize, hey,
right?
Maybe there wasn't actually a dude called Jesus. So is there really that much evidence to argue that Jesus didn't exist in real life at all?
Well, I'll tell you, I was in the exact same boat as you were. I had been a happy atheist for 16 years, and it never even crossed my mind to think there was no Jesus. And ironically enough, what got me on this whole track was when I was reading, you know, the Gospels. When you read them, all 4 of our Gospels show very different Jesuses. I mean, they're all supposed to be the same guy, all supposed to be telling the same story, and yet they're coming from 4 very different perspectives and having them do completely different things. In fact, if you take the first 3 Gospels in John, they're not even doing the same thing. You know, the stories are not the same at all. So this really confused me, and I started wondering, well, which is the real Jesus, and which is just the legendary creation that came, you know, over the centuries, this legendary buildup. And once you start trying to parse out what's real and fake about the Jesus story, that's when you start running into trouble. And I say in the book Nailed, once you start pulling on that thread, pretty soon you find out you have no sweater. And I even have a chapter in the end of Nailed called Can Jesus Be Saved?, where I talk about all the things that would be different in our New Testament, in Christian history, in Middle Eastern history, if Jesus was just a guy, just one more failed Messiah of the first century. And ultimately, in Nailed, I say it came down to this paradox, that either you had this guy who did all these amazing things, or at the very least taught all these amazing, wonderful things, and yet no one seems to have known about him outside his little cult for the better part of a century. Or he didn't do these things, he didn't teach these amazing things, And yet, as soon as he's dead, you have all these feuding little cultlets scattered not just in Galilee, not just in Judea, but all over the Roman Empire and beyond. And they can't seem to agree about the first fact about his life. And that alone was the biggest red flag for me. And that was about 20 years ago that I first came to that conclusion. And now I don't even see how it could be possible there was a guy named Jesus. There's nothing implausible about it on the face of things. There's nothing, I mean, there were plenty of messiahs at the time. It's just that when we look at what our evidence is, it's not pointing to a real dude. It's pointing to a Jewish attempt to create a Jewish version of the mystery faiths.
Now, can you talk a little bit about there were plenty of messiahs around at that time? Like,
right. And the funny thing about that, too, is we have plenty of evidence for like a half dozen or more of these other, more than a half dozen of these other guys who are much less interesting than Jesus for the most part. And yet every single one of them did pulled off a trick that Jesus couldn't do. They got a write-up in the local histories. We have information about them, and it's generally we have more information about them than we have about Jesus. One of them, including John the Baptist, and it wouldn't shock me to find out that John the Baptist was a complete myth too, and yet we have slightly better evidence for him than we do for Jesus.
No way.
Not great evidence, but there's some, yeah.
So what are the reasons that folks kind of do claim that there's this historical Jesus, this dude, even if you didn't believe that he was a reincarnated son of God or an incarnation of
right.
something magical?
Right. Well, I think most people were like me and you. We just assumed there was, because where else did Christianity come from if not from this dude, you know? And the story's been told and kind of shoved down our throats so much, we don't stop to think about all the problems with the story. And as we come around for Christmas and they start telling the nativity story, if you do more than watch the Charlie Brown Christmas special and actually read the source material we have two Christmas stories, two nativity stories, and they're not the same story at all. If you had read Matthew's Christmas story and never read Luke's Christmas story, or vice versa, if you'd read Luke's and never read Matthew's, you would never know half the things that we've crammed together from these two separate stories.
Now, in terms of like having two different stories, two different perspectives, I'm certain that my younger brother would write a completely different biography of Becky Friedman than, say, my best friend who is my coworker. Is it really enough to say that these two different accounts, one from Matthew and one from Luke, is enough to ring those skeptic alarm bells and say, nah, this is all made up?
Well, that's a great question. And you could say that for just about every single aspect of his so-called biographical information, from his birth to his death and everything in between. But the fact is, when you read Matthew's story, it's a completely different kind of story. It's a scary story. It's a suspenseful story. It's a chase story. There's all this drama and internal court and skullduggery going on. And the family is on the run, has to go to Egypt and come back and hide out from Herod and then hide out from Herod's sons. Whereas in Luke's story, it's this happy feel-good story. And, you know, from the get-go, happy, happy, happy. Everyone's delighted. They're all, you know, all the prophets are telling everyone in Jerusalem about the new Messiah. And there's no angst whatsoever. And he even has Joseph and Mary and the family going back and forth to Jerusalem for Passover many times during the time that Matthew has them hiding out in Egypt.
Hold up, David. You just said Passover, okay? That happens in, like, springtime. We all know that Jesus was born on December 25th, you know, like around the solstice, right? Right? Help me out with this. You said
right?
Passover.
Except that's funny because it never tells us anywhere in the Gospels when he was born. And the only thing close to a definitive answer to that is pastors will say, well, shepherds were watching their fields by night. So it was probably, you know, late September or something like that. And that's the kind of guesswork that plagues everything in Jesus' historical studies. At best, they're not even saying anything about proof about Jesus. They're saying, well, since Jesus was a Judean male at this age and this period, then blah, 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 blah. He must have blah, 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 blah. And it's a total guessing game they're playing. That's the same reason we know things like who is the actual author of the Gospel of John, supposedly, because it never identifies itself as being written by John, just like none of the other Gospels identify themselves as being written by anyone by name. Those names have been attached to it in the second century.
There were a lot of, I guess you could say, historical writings and historians that were recording things at that time. Can you take us through some of the writings that people generally turn to support their argument that a dude named Jesus did exist, whether or not he was God or not?
Right. Well, I think the biggest one they go to is the Gospels themselves. And they say, oh, these are four independent historical accounts of Jesus, when in fact what they are, they're all dependent on our first and oldest gospel, the Gospel of Mark, which is also the most low rent, no frill, basic gospel, where Jesus isn't that impressive. He fails, he screws up sometimes, and he starts out as just a guy that at his baptism, God adopts him as his son. And because he was faithful all the way through death, God promotes him at his death to Lord. And it could not be more different from the last gospel we have, the Gospel of John, where he starts out as this pre-existent figure with God at the beginning of creation, comes to earth, slums around for 33 years, just acting like he's above it all and telling everyone he's the Son of God, and then going back to heaven as if to prove a point with this magic trick of being raised from the dead. It's amazing to see the differences just between that first gospel and that fourth gospel. And again, these are Christian writings written by Christians to sell Christianity. They're not historical documents in the sense that we would call them historical documents, even though Luke pretends to be writing history, when actually what he's doing is copying the story from Mark and Matthew for the most part.
Okay. Well, let's go to something outside of the Gospels. This guy, Josephus.
Flavius Josephus, yeah.
Why do religious scholars love on him so much?
There's one particularly good reason, and that's because without Flavius Josephus, let me back up a little bit. Flavius Josephus is a Jewish historian from the first century, the late first century, I should say. He was born after Jesus was meant to have died, and he wrote almost to the second century in the 90s. But the reason that anyone pays any attention to him is because there's two passages that are supposedly about Jesus. And one is a out-and-out fraud. It's a complete interpolation. The other is talking about a completely different person. It's very obvious from reading the context of that it's not talking about our Jesus. And yet, people have been digging their claws, and they're so reluctant to give up those two suspected forgeries, disputed passages, because without them, we have absolutely no historical corroboration for the Gospels whatsoever in the entire first century. And we don't really get any corroboration anywhere near contemporary to Jesus' time. And what we do get are starting around the second century. So are things that are based on the Gospels, not based on any actual history.
So when you say that one of Josephus's writings that mentions a guy named Yeshua or whatnot, that was just some other dude that happened to have the same name? I mean, like, Rebecca's a fairly common name. David's a fairly common name. Maybe, you know,
right,
some person 70 years from now is writing about David Fitzgerald and happens to be a footballer.
Right. But in the case I'm talking about, it actually mentions who they're talking about. It mentions him by name, that this is Jesus ben Ananias. And it makes sense in the context. Oh, you're talking about this son of this high priest. It makes no sense if it's supposed to be Jesus's brother we're talking about. And the one part of that passage where it seems to say James, really Jacob, son of Ananias, has been changed to brother of Jesus who was called Christ. But in fact, it's Jacob, brother of Jesus, ben Ananias, the guy we're actually talking about in this whole section. It's very clear when you read it and when you read it nailed the discussion of it. It's not even meant to even pretend to be our Jesus.
So this is sort of a modern eye. And by modern, we could be talking about 12th century, for instance, looking back and really grasping at, please, see, there's a little thing that supports my entire existence and identity that Jesus was a thing.
Right, right. And in fact, we have early Christian fathers complaining about Josephus never mentioning Jesus, which is hilarious. And we even know the name of the guy who was probably the one who forged the passage that claims to be about Jesus, our Jesus.
Do we know that through just interpolation, or what's the evidence for that?
Well, one thing, for instance, we have an early church father who's complaining that Josephus never mentions Jesus when he should have. That same guy later gave his copies of his books to a guy who gave them to this guy Eusebius. And Eusebius suddenly, 300 years after Josephus has been writing, 300 years where Christian fathers love quoting him on all other sorts of subjects, all of a sudden he says, oh yeah, and there's this passage in Josephus. He quotes it three times in various contexts, and then nobody else for another 200 years ever quotes it. So for 500 years, apparently this one dude supposedly knows about it. And he knows about it from a book that he got from a guy who complained about Jesus, Josephus never talking about Jesus. And even when you read the passage itself, no one doubts that it's at least a partial forgery, because it doesn't fit the section that's in at all. It's like, this sad thing happened in Jerusalem, this sad thing, this happened, thing, another sad calamity. But tucked in the middle of this is this little paragraph that says, oh, and at this time there was a guy named Jesus, and he was great and wonderful, and Jews loved him, and those who loved him did not forsake him, blah, blah, blah. It's this commercial for Jesus stuck in the middle of this litany of horrible things happening in Jerusalem. And it's written from this guy who's this cheerleader for Jesus, who's supposed to be a member of the Sanhedrin and a Pharisee. And it's like, what? There's no question, and really in scholarly circles, there's no question that it's at very least a partial forgery. And the argument has become, well, is it a total forgery or is it just a partial forgery and some Christian embellished it? But when you actually, I mean, for this and all the several reasons I've been telling you earlier, I mean, there's just no way that thing is legitimate. Full stop. The whole thing, it completely does not fit the context.
I love the idea of a commercial for Jesus stuck in the middle of something bad. It's sort of like, hey, we're going to wake you up from this terrible thing and just remind you that we like this Jesus guy. And okay.
And the funny thing is, with that little mini paragraph, and it's tiny compared to the rest of the passages too, but this little V snippet, when it ends, the next line is, and then another sad calamity struck Jerusalem. It's like, wait. That calamity, you're just talking about how great Jesus was. But if you take out that, it's like, oh yeah, it's been a whole lineup of calamity after calamity in this. But,
wow.
So there's that.
So you did mention that was something that that scholars actually do kind of agree on, but why has scholarly consensus seemed to accept a historical Jesus? That's my question. I mean, you don't work as an academic in a university.
You're right, absolutely.
Careful researcher that has delved, deep dive into this. But why are scholars assuming that Jesus was a thing?
It's what I call the Belfast analogy. And not to go too far down a rabbit hole, but basically biblical scholarship, and especially Jesus studies, is this tiny subfield within the bigger context of historical studies. And in that tiny context, it's the only field of studies where Christians are the dominant majority of this. And so theological interests have always kind of permeated what gets accepted as the consensus. And I'll give you an example of something not related to Jesus history. But 30 years ago, Thomas Thompson was a scholar who came up with espousing that the argument that most of the figures in the Torah, in the historical sections of the Tanakh, are mythological characters, like Samson, like Abraham, like Moses. Most of the big name players were completely mythological, and he almost had his career stomped out right from the beginning. And yet 30 years after that, he was a professor in Europe, because in that time, his blasphemous idea that these were mythological characters had become the consensus idea in European biblical studies.
Hmm.
And we see the exact same reaction to this as we did then. In fact, the whole history of biblical studies has been this kind of reaction, because I say in one of my books, maybe it was Nailed, maybe it's the other one, that all changes in history, I'm losing my own quote here. Basically, I'll say this, all changes in biblical history begin as blasphemy.
I like it.
And yeah.
I can see that as someone who, you know, in college, I took a Hebrew Scriptures as Literature course, you know, one of those Bibles mm-hmm. as Lit courses, and the professor happened to be a Jewish man, but he, as many Jewish Americans are, you know, very atheistic in his own views, and had gone into
yeah.
that out of personal interest of your, you know, something connecting with your heritage. I can see that it would be very strange and maybe not a pursuit that a lot of non-religious people would be drawn to in the first place, unless you had a specific reaction to religion, like, you know, maybe you were very faithful and then wanted to
absolutely
to study it from an atheistic perspective.
Absolutely. And in fact, most biblical historians, even today, even most secular biblical historians, began as Christian or Jewish or Catholic or Protestant biblical historians, including our most famous secular ones like Bart Ehrman. And yet, when you look at, I'll take Bart Ehrman because he's sort of like the standard bearer for, oh, yes, of course there was a Jesus that's slayed to think there was not Jesus. When you look at his core of work and the research he's done on how Christianity was forged, how early Christianity is remarkable for the degree to which its early scriptures were forged and changed back and forth between factions, showcasing the problems and the biases with in biblical studies that have permeated it from the get-go, you see that for a staunch historicist, he's also one of the best mythicist writers out there.
Hmm.
Yeah, I've been saying that for ages. There's a thing called the historical quest for Jesus, and some people don't like that paradigm, but a lot of people will talk about, there's been three major periods in biblical history of what they call the historical quest for Jesus, starting in 1900 with Albert Schweitzer, and then going through these different phases. And at the end of each of these phases, and supposedly we're coming out of the third one, each one of them is ended with the scholars throwing up their hands and saying, oh, no, wait a second. These rules of criteria that we came to determine authenticity don't work. Oh, because, you know, logic, because reasons, you know. And so they've made three different approaches of this, and every single one of them, we wind up knowing less about Jesus than we did before. It's the opposite of any other field of history, let alone science, that the more we study Jesus, the less we know for certain about him, and the more uncertainty we have about him. And Christians were complaining about this in the 30s and the 40s and the 60s and the 80s. And most recently, Christian scholars, biblical scholars, were talking about this demise of authenticity. And they were doing it from the standpoint of, well, we're Christians and we have to have faith, and we can't rely on fallible history to bolster our faith, inadvertently kind of admitting that, yeah, there's a reason why they can't rely on historical evidence, because they don't have good historical evidence for Jesus. And I want to make it really clear, again, there's nothing improbable about there being a guy like Jesus. But when we look at our evidence for him, for all extents and purposes, even if there was a Jesus, the evidence for him is so bad, there might as well not be a Jesus anymore, because anything we think we know about him is not based on anyone who actually lived in the first century, whether there was a Jesus or not, whether Christianity is true or not. And that's what I try to get the word out to people when they try to say, oh, you're bucking the consensus, or, oh, you know, all historians agree there was no Jesus.
given all of that, you know, not only do you as an atheist not believe in a son of God type Jesus, you don't believe necessarily that there was a mortal guy that existed just based on our lack of evidence. Do you find any value in a symbolic Jesus, especially around Christmas time?
You know, that's a great question. And of course I do. I mean, in a Joseph Campbellian sense, you know, myths are very powerful and we can learn things. And they're just beautiful as an art form and a cultural touchstone. Just the way, you know, atheist Jews have a touchstone with, you know, Judaism through the ages. And there's a beauty to that. It's when we take our myths seriously as empirical fact, that's when it becomes a problem. You know, Aesop's fables are beautiful, but if we started having people on the PTA school board say, no, we must teach the hare and tortoise as literal fact, you know, and promote that, that's when you get the problems. And that's definitely an American problem, if not a world problem.
Definitely feel that as someone working in education. What are you working on at the moment, David?
Right at the moment, we've got two major projects happening. We are finishing up book 3 of Time Shards, which is due January 20th. And so we are scrambling to get that done.
Amazing. And we haven't even had you on to talk about the second in the series. I think that'll be probably a conversation for another day. But
I think we'll have to, because that just came out. Book 2 just came out this fall, and the audiobook just came out a few weeks ago, maybe even days ago. Super fun. The other project is we found out our rent has been bumped up to $4,100. So we are moving from San Francisco to Northern California, a town called Eureka. And
big change.
That's all happening. Big changes. It's like the 2020s are going to be new decade, new life, new city, new everything.
Yeah, definitely.
Hopefully new president too.
One can hope, maybe.
And I should say the next nonfiction book is going to be in the Complete Heretic's Guide to Western Religion series, the same series that gave us the Mormons and Jesus Mything in Action. I'm going to be working on two books at the same time, Sex and Violence in the Bible, which is based off my talk that you can find on YouTube, and Fun with the Jehovah's Witnesses. So those will be the next heretic-related themes I'm working on after we finish Time Shards 3.
Where can listeners follow up with your work and what's coming next?
Gotcha. Probably best to just find me on Facebook. You can also send me emails at everybodylovesdave@gmail.com. And you can find the books wherever books are sold, online or in brick and mortar stores.
Well, amazing to have you back. I'm super happy for this conversation, especially around Christmas time or Notmas time. We're not sure.
Happy Hanukkah.
So, David Fitzgerald, you're a writer and historical researcher. Your works have ranged from sci-fi to nonfiction. You've been a guest on Ask an Atheist, and we're so happy to have you back. Really a pleasure talking with you today about Jesus. You are listening to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Find us at atheist.radio, and we'll be back after the break. Hello, and welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey, where you can ask us any question that you got, whether it's about Jesus and whether he existed, or Tool fans, Christmas music, weather, all those kinds of things. In the meantime, I want to bring David's expertise back a little bit for this next story. A petition calling for Netflix to axe an irreverent comedy featuring a gay youthful Jesus has garnered more than 1 million signatures. The First Temptation of Christ is a Portuguese language production from Brazilian YouTubers with a satirical take on Jesus' 30th birthday, wherein he brings a male date to the party. It was premiered on Netflix Brazil in December. The Brazilian president's son, Eduardo Bolsonaro, took to social media to post that he supports freedom of expression, but questioned, is it worth attacking the belief of 86% of the population? A bishop from Pernambuco State characterized the film as blasphemous, vulgar, and disrespectful, and urged subscribers to cancel the streaming service. Porta dos Fundos, whose name is a pun and idiom akin to backdoor, had a 2018 Netflix special depicting Jesus as having gone missing with a hangover after the Last Supper, but that film did not garner such widespread condemnation comparatively. David, what do you make of this? Our fake Jesus turns out is gay.
Adorable. I kind of love that. And I love the fact that, oh, we're all for freedom of speech unless you actually use it. Except when it's blasphemy. Then it's completely wrong.
Blasphemy is the best kind of free speech, right?
Thank you. If you can't blaspheme, you don't have freedom of speech. Full stop, period.
Is it worth attacking the belief of 86% of the population? Resounding answer? Yes.
Yes. Yeah. I think it's adorable when people come up with something that's obviously satirical and everybody loses their minds. You know? it's Life of Brian all over again.
Do you think that there's any kind of, I don't know, parallels to the Gospels and the process that happened in terms of writing about Jesus, whether it was 300 years after his supposed existence or 2,000 years after his supposed existence?
Well, there is, in fact, an apocryphal gospel called the Secret Gospel of Mark, wherein it's heavily, heavily implied that Jesus is a big homosexual.
No.
And that may be a fake gospel, but that's certainly a true fact of history, that we have an ancient manuscript that purports that Jesus was gay.
Amazing.
If it's legit, and I don't know 100% if it is or isn't, but it is hilarious to think that that's out there somewhere.
Take that, Bolsonaro Jr.
Exactly.
Well, I wasn't actually all that interested in watching this until now, and now I'm actually kind of intrigued.
Yeah, so am I. I wonder if this can actually be either dubbed in English or if I don't know, there are probably subtitles on the Portuguese version, and you could at least get some kind of rough translation through just a machine.
Is it available in the United States yet? I've got to look into that.
I'm not certain at this point, but there's definitely been petitions that have sprung up from U.S.-based outraged individuals who are also saying, why don't we, you know, axe our subscriptions, or Netflix should be ashamed of itself. My favorite thing is that Netflix is refusing to comment on this whatsoever. I mean, it's my favorite thing, but also I kind of wish that Netflix would say, chill out. It's satire. We have lots of objectionable things. We have lots of things that you will find objectionable. We also have a bazillion documentaries on the supposed historicity of your Jesus. Yeah. So they're carrying everything that they're moneymakers, right?
Yeah, it sounds like this is a Brazilian Monty Python group from what David was saying. Instead of attacking back, though, maybe they should think about why that causes such a visceral reaction.
I know that I wouldn't have that same kind of reaction if someone, decided to turn Homer Simpson gay, because I just see this as just another character in another story.
Now, I'm not super familiar with New Testament scripture because I didn't grow up immersed in that, and I haven't taken the time to do a lot of studying of that particular source material for religion. But as far as I know, it's mostly Hebrew scriptures that have all of the condemnations of same-sex, you know, sexual interactions, that Jesus doesn't really say much at all about any kind of pairings and couplings.
Yeah, from my recollection, there isn't much. But as a group, conservative Christians tend to be extremely homophobic. It makes sense they'd be upset about it, even though they shouldn't be.
I couldn't imagine having that same kind of reaction if instead of Jesus's love life, what if you changed the fish and bread that, you know, he fed all those people with? What if you replaced it with, I don't know, polenta and hot dogs? Would they have the same reaction? I don't think so.
Well, I don't know. Is there any milk in polenta? Because then you're mixing milk and meat. That's Hebrew scriptures prohibitions. Okay.
Does the polenta have a sauce with it?
I did not think about that.
So, I mean, if your polenta has a good sauce to keep it from, it could go well with hot dogs.
Why would you defoul polenta by adding hot dogs to it?
If it's what you have available, you know?
You see, your reaction to that is way more legitimate than someone bellyaching about Jesus's, well, attractions to people.
If that, yep. You know, there's other places where people have interpreted the life and story of Jesus, and one of them is in San Diego, where an 88-year-old Pentecostal faith healing televangelist. Oh, that's a mouthful. that's a lot of labels you got there, dude. All right, let's start this again. An 88-year-old Pentecostal faith healing televangelist has unveiled a Bible-themed retreat center in San Diego that he says holds widespread appeal for both secular and Christian tourists. Morris Cerullo's $190 billion Legacy International Center, sorry, I think I meant million there, features Bible quote signs, a 4D theater telling the Exodus story, fake catacombs lined with New Testament themed murals, a mock wailing wall, fountains reminiscent of Las Vegas's Bellagio Resort, and an international market featuring products from locales where Cerullo has executed the majority of his ministry. Built around parables from the Bible, the attraction will be heavy on technology with interactive touch screens and a multi-action table that bring comic book stories to life in the children's section. Cerullo built the center debt-free using proceeds from the sale of his ministry's headquarters, along with donations from his followers.
I'm definitely in the wrong business.
You want to be building comic book immersive entertainment resorts?
Yeah, that sounds awesome, actually.
It actually does sound pretty cool. The only thing that I'm not digging about this is the
theme,
idea that
they're
Bible themed.
Yeah, the whole Bible theme.
At least the way that this is made is a little bit better than Ken Ham's little failed experiment.
Well, there are those different theme parks. You're talking, I think, now about the Creation Museum and the Ark Park, right?
Yeah,
the Ark Experience.
Yeah.
Both in Kentucky. So, neither of which have really brought good tourism money to the areas.
And they also, I believe, they got public dollars to help finance it.
Or at least they got major tax breaks.
Yeah.
And which ended up not being as effective at bringing people in as the governments were told.
Yeah, just look up interviews of people who own businesses in the town where that park is.
Yeah.
Well, maybe that's why this guy, Morris Cerullo, is so keen on showing off that his whole resort and tourism attraction was built completely debt-free. But I'm looking here. Whose debt?
Yeah. It was not his debt, but he got a bunch of people to give him money who were probably in debt.
So, you know, you donate to a ministry thinking it's going to go to charity.
Right.
And what happens? They build a theme park and conference center with it.
When my grandfather died, he had a $90,000 mortgage on his property. He was 97. And there is no reason for him to have that. The money was all gone. The guess is he donated it to a ministry.
Ah, these are the kinds of things that can break our hearts when you have someone that may be lonely, may be vulnerable, and people are duping them into tithing.
Yes.
Under some kind of supposed prescription and mandate to do so. I want to dig in a little bit, though, to the claim. Not that claim was that Jesus was real, or that the 10 plagues happened, or that having an immersive comic book story will be a good way to indoctrinate teenagers into believing in Christianity, but into this claim that this will have widespread appeal for both secular and Christian tourists. It's reminding me of one little, Blues Brothers little line. You guys familiar with this one?
You know what? I can put my own spin on that. You know what? My band appeals to everyone for all kinds of music, from Yes to Tool. I mean, all different types of prog rock are represented.
What about the non-prog rock people?
What, they don't exist? Just like the not secular.
What you mean?
Christian.
You mean people? Oh. What you mean? People who listen to Rush?
Yeah.
No, this really is stinking of we like all types of music, country and western.
Yeah.
Mr. Cerullo, you might not be aware, but there are more types of humans with religious orientations or disinclinations besides just Christian individuals and secular individuals. And also, as a secular individual, what would be my motivation for staying at your Bible resort? How is that ever going? going to appeal to me other than to perhaps, if I was costing you money and not paying anything, to go and ridicule it or from an investigative journalistic perspective.
I can say that I'm never going to spend my money at any of these resorts or museums. I avoid them, honestly.
Those were heavy scare quotes in museum, right?
Yeah, museum.
Well, this guy actually does have some artifacts that he will have on display, like, you know, old illuminated Bibles, and he has a Torah scroll that was saved from a congregation whose individuals perished in the Holocaust. So, like, there are some artifacts
that would be worthy of
museum things.
I'm still not going to give him any of my money.
I would much rather see those kinds of things in another venue.
Yeah.
Wait, but what about a 4D immersive viewing movie experience venue?
They have those at Disneyland.
What, like Smell-O-Vision?
Yes! No, like, I'm just imagining telling the Exodus story through kind of that big IMAX domed theater or something like that. And then what does your seat do, right? During the parting of the Red Sea, are you the part of the Egyptian that gets, like, splashed? Are they going to dump water on you and drown you like an Egyptian? Or are they going to just spritz water on you because you were an Israelite passing through the parted sea?
Of course you're a successful Israelite.
Well, what about if you happen to be around as a successful Israelite when the locust plague is coming? Are they going to, like, release a lot of insects in the theater?
You're not supposed to think about that.
Among the things I'm not supposed to think about, like, you know, whether Jesus existed or not. So we hear that this is built upon the donations from followers. And this guy, Morris Cerullo, has spent 70 years mostly doing ministry abroad, mostly doing ministry throughout Russia and Africa and Indonesia and South America. These are the places that he is targeting for people to give him money. And what does it mean when someone is giving him money? He also is well known and controversial, at least in the UK, for being a faith healer. Of course, he doesn't say that he's the faith healer. He says he's just, you know, allowing God to heal or facilitating that God heals someone. Where we have young people that are presented at one of these faith healing events and say, yes, God has cured you. Meanwhile, the child will die 2 weeks henceforth of neuroblastoma. Or the individual who believed that she is treated and cured from her severe epilepsy, so stops taking her medication and then drowns in the tub after having a seizure through lack of having a controlled through medication. These are the kinds of things that are in Cerullo's legacy. So while it's super funny and fun to just joke about, you know, a comic book sci-fi parable for the teens or Smell-O-Vision for fun for the whole family, this is a guy that has done demonstrable damage to people's lives, demonstrable harm. You know, how many grandpas are 97 years old having mortgaged their house giving to this kind of guy?
Right. Now, this guy, he's 88. He's about to die. He's building a monument of himself or a monument of his life. It's his pyramid.
It's literally called Legacy Center.
It's literally his pyramid that he is building for when he dies.
You know, these kinds of laughable caricatures are not the only places where we see these kinds of really insidious predatory behavior. A whistleblower who has served as a former financial advisor for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints nonprofit investment division has filed an IRS complaint claiming that the church has built a $100 billion investment portfolio using donations meant for charity. David Nielsen warned that the nonprofit investment division could owe billions in unpaid taxes, explaining that around 1/7 of all church donations are transferred yearly to an investment portfolio managed by Ensign Peak Advisors. He claims that funds in the investment portfolio have not been utilized for charitable purposes at all in the past 22 years, but have been used on occasion to support for-profit businesses. Nielsen, who resigned from employment with Ensign because his family had left the LDS Church, is also seeking an IRS reward for his report since the agency offers whistleblowers a portion of recovered taxes. He expressed shame at having encouraged tithing by exceedingly destitute members of the church and called on donors to critically examine the value of tithing to the LDS church.
So I read through the article in this the Tribune here, and they mentioned this lady that didn't have her, she didn't buy food for like, or tortillas at least, for a week in order to properly tithe to the church so that they would have money for charity to help feed people. But in reality, they're just taking that money and investing like 50% of it in stocks and bonds so they can buy bigger churches or invest in private businesses.
Or buying radio stations in the Seattle area.
Yeah.
Oh, is the LDS Church all about that now? We'll see.
Well, they do have a pretty big media company.
Well, these kinds of things are what we, as critical examiners of where we put our money, want to look at. And whether it's a nonprofit that's seeking your end of year donations in order to say, hey, get your giving in so that you can have it as your tax write-off, whether it's a secular nonprofit, whether it's something associated with some kind of affinity, look and see where that money is going. And one of the insidious things about the way that church nonprofits, religious nonprofits are set up in the U.S. is they are not held to the same kind of reporting standards as non-religious nonprofits. Those kinds of things are obscured from public view. And so it does take the work of a whistleblower to say, this is something that I find to be reprehensible, and bring it to light.
And isn't a lot of that aren't a lot of those statistics self-reported anyway?
They are. That those are the on the option of the reporting church to say, right, what are you doing with your charitable donations? What does your finance portfolio look like?
And of course, they're always going to be honest.
Well, I think that that's all we've got today for Ask an Atheist. But I'm sure that this is not the last that we will hear of the LDS Church, of tithing, of Matt Shea, or of Jesus. If you want to give us a ring, 844-SKEPTIC and leave us a voicemail. Find us at atheist.radio. Find us at Ask an Atheist WA on Twitter and Facebook. Happy Newton, Moss!